Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. Let me ask President Lewis my first question. You mentioned both the Heard Museum Indian Market and the Santa Fe Indian Market in your testimony, both of which attract hundreds of artists to sell their crafts and thousands of art collectors seeking to purchase authentic Indian arts and crafts. Do you know what is done at these markets to ward off counterfeited and misrepresented Indian goods?
Mr. Chairman, I may have to refer that to one of the artists that actually are there. I've gone as a patron and as a customer personally, but I currently do not know what is being done at the market during the time of the festival.
President Garcia?
Well, IACB sits up there and passes out literature. We're there, Indian Arts and Crafts Association. We're passing out literature. There's so many people, it's hard to make an impact. There's like an estimated 85,000 people come to Santa Fe of a city of 50,000 people. It's the state is out there. I mean, we're SWEA. I was also vice chairman of the SWEA, the people that put on Santa Fe Indian Market for 4 years. They have monitors out there. Because people are walking up and down the sidewalks, people are on the sidewalks. It's overflowed and gotten so big, it's hard to police. It really is. And a lot of the shops, it's difficult. It's difficult. It would take a substantial force to really police Santa Fe Indian Market and what goes on there. The actual vendors that are selling at the market, all their documentation, check their docs, or their tribal documentation. They're certain. You have to be juried into that show as a tribal member by a federally recognized tribe. So it's a difficult process to try to police something that big. But, I mean, like I mentioned, through educational literature and just talking to people and stuff and seminars and things, it's a start.
Let me ask both President Lewis and you, Jewel, to your knowledge, do any of the Arizona tribes have tribal regulations regarding the sale of Indian arts and crafts on their reservations?
On specific reservations, I do not know that, Mr. Chairman.
Good. How about you, Joel?
The only thing that we have really is the what's within our Constitution authorizing the tribe to develop regulations for regulating arts and crafts. So we can if we choose to. It's just that there's never been a market for the tribe to really invest that much effort into regulating it.
Joel, does the... Scratch that. In your testimony, you eloquently state that the use of artistic symbolism is directly tied to tribal methods of teaching protection, respect, and preservation of the surrounding enviros. What has been the impact of imported or misrepresented Indian goods on the Lummi people and their artists?
Well, it's we don't allow the art to be imported. But when we encounter the art that's like for sale at SeaTac and some of the other stores, recently, for example, we went out to the San Juan Islands. We attempted to develop an arts and crafts festival in cooperation with local artists and went into the stores and found these knockoffs from Asia. And so that does have a direct impact. Our problem is that we're hoping to develop the arts and crafts in association with our fisheries. That's why we included language in our testimony. It says that we're hoping that Congress will clarify that our knowledge about how these symbols are important to public awareness and education for teaching how to manage the environment and salmon habitat, that it's really important from one generation to the next, and it's important to our relationship with the surrounding public, that we use these symbols to always keep in the minds of the public that you have to protect the rivers, you have to protect the salmon, you have to protect the salmon species, including the forest. That it's a duty, it's a public duty, and that we have to teach it from parent to child, from generation to generation. So I think that's our biggest problem. Right now we're focusing on developing an opportunity to take the few fish we have and include it and incorporate it with some of our arts that our families that are poverty-stricken can create and attach to the finished product, in this case, smoked salmon or canned salmon.
President Garcia, in your testimony, you state that the Indian Arts and Crafts Association allows the use of its logo to certify reputable businesses.
Yes.
Can you explain to us what that process is?
It means you can buy with confidence with someone that is bearing our logo. What we do is we spot check people if there's questions or anybody brings up any kind of questions. Or when someone joins our organization, they go through an application process. You just don't sign up and you're a member. You have to be approved. You have to have references by somebody in the organization. So we our slogan is you can buy with confidence if you see the IACA logo. So like I said, when complaints do come up, we do go out to businesses. We've been known to go out to people's shops or a place of business and spot check them and see what if complaint is true, if they're using non-native labor or they're using non-native, selling non-native goods and things. But what they do away from our organization is their business. What we care about is what they're doing with our organization and they could have another store down the road and selling who knows what. That's not what we're concerned about. It's what we're doing and what our logo, how it's being represented. If I may, Chairman Ray Hall, he's getting back to some of the one of the things I neglected to put in my written testimony was to make a request and recommendation that the Government Accountability Office conduct an appropriate study to ascertain the precise dollar value of monies lost due to counterfeit arts and crafts. There's nothing really on the books that says what the exact dollar amount is, other than the statement that was put out by the Department of the Interior Inspector General, which said it was a $1 billion industry. There's something we need to know, some exact figures. Myself, as a native artist, I know how it's hurt me and how, I mean, people will come to, I do very high quality work, very unique lapidary work, and they can go down the street and get the same thing for the Philippines for a third of the cost. So, I mean, I look at, they're saying 40-50%, the Inspector General, of that money is going to fakes and fraud. That's 40-50% of monies that I'm losing also as a native artist.
We will seriously consider that request.
Thank you, sir.
SGAO do that. Mr. Hastings?
Thank you. Mr. Garcia, in your testimony, you said that the counterfeit crafts generally is the jewelry. Is that by far the artist's work that is most counterfeited in your experience?
It has been in the past. It has been just in the last problem since the internet age. It's become more everything across the board.
And you mentioned, and I was going to ask what you thought the costs were, but you answered that by asking for a GAO report. But you mentioned the incident in the 70s. Could you elaborate on that?
In 1970, there was a boom. In the early mid-70s, there was a boom going on in native jewelry. But it was in those days, it was anybody and everybody was making it. I used to call everybody and their cousin was making jewelry and stuff. And a certain group of people came in from the Middle East and basically just flooded our market. I mean, devastated our market. They set up in Gallup. They set up in all up and down Central Avenue in Albuquerque, and I know because I was there and I lived it. I mean, I felt it and stuff. And they were bringing Zuni style inlay. They were bringing stuff in from Mexico, overlay, Hopi style. At that time, there was only three types of native jewelry: Hopi, Zuni, and Navajo. Now everything's kind of everybody's crossed over and contemporary and things. But they flooded our market so bad with Native American jewelry, counterfeit jewelry, that I couldn't make a living at it. My relatives couldn't make a living at it. It devastated my family and stuff. My uncles, who I learned from, then they quit making it and never went back to it because it took up from 19. This was like the mid 70s, and it wasn't until I started making jewelry again in 91. And it wasn't because of the Arts and Crafts Act. It's just like timing, I guess. But it was I couldn't believe how law enforcement or nobody would do nothing to help us. They literally flooded the market. I mean, flooded it in the Southwest with counterfeits.
Has a law that is in place now helped to mitigate at least what did happen in the 70s?
Well, it gives you a place to go and complain. Right. But I think there needs to be more prosecution.
Right. Well, I mean, that's the reason for the law here.
Right.
Obviously, why we're having this testimony. But I just wondered if that has had at least some mitigating effect.
Personally, myself, on my experience, I would say no, it hasn't really helped me as an artisan. Maybe because there's not enough proof. on what people are doing in my work. Like I said, the stuff on eBay that pops up.
Right.
I mean, I can only speak for myself. And I, you know, I would say that that's why we're here, to make it easier and make the punishment more severe. Because there's a lot of it going out there in the Southwest. A lot of it, believe me.
Okay, good. Thank you all for your testimony. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for having this hearing. As a native New Mexican, I'm very familiar with the beautiful pieces made by Native Americans, and I appreciate Ed Pastor introducing this important legislation that will bring an end to counterfeiting that will help go and punish those who violate. And my question goes to the Native American craft that is being produced here in the United States. You're producing it right here in the United States, is that correct? And any one of you can answer that.
Yeah, I am, yes.
And so,
yes.
And so when we look at the counterfeit, that may not be done right here in the United States, is that correct?
Correct.
Some of it may be, some of it may not.
May or may not, but we don't know. But it's counterfeit, and it may or may not. So my question is that what is the impact it's having in terms of the job crisis? Because you're producing those jobs, you're creating those jobs right here, you're doing it yourself, while we're looking at counterfeit that is done somewhere else and sold right here, not creating the jobs, not creating the opportunity, and then not being able to pass it from one generation to another generation, because you're passing it from one generation to another versus the counterfeit that can't be passed to anyone else because it's done somewhere else. Is that correct? And would you like to elaborate, any one of you three, on that?
I know in the Pacific Northwest, one of the dreams that we had as the House of Tears Carvers was that we would be able to utilize our totem art throughout the community, both on and off reservation, but also begin to tie it with some ecotourism so that we can bring people into the mountains and show them the beauty of the rivers and the streams that produce the salmon, but also associate it with some of the symbology of our native art so that they can appreciate the art itself and appreciate some of the traditional knowledge that reinforces the relationship with the environment, because our vision was that we'd be able to actually provide tourism for where some of the tribal members that would have been fishermen that could no longer be a fisherman because the fish stocks have been depleted can now get involved in ecotourism by not only bringing tourists into the mountains and showing them the streams, but then bringing them out and showing them the totem poles, telling them the stories, then introducing them to the native artists that have it for sale. But with the knockoff copies, it's cheaper to buy it on your way out while you're at SeaTac.
And what impact then does it have on Indian country, though, itself? Is because now you have counterfeiters and others that are doing it in terms of the jobs that could be created and the opportunities for individuals to learn the craft too as well. What impact is it having there?
For us, it's demoralizing because we take the time to teach the young people as well, and including elders that are trying to recover culture, how to take the raw materials, in this case Western Red Cedar or Yellow Cedar, and turn it into a work of art. And during that process, they're learning the stories, or they're learning how to use it in appropriate song, dance, and ceremony. They're learning that it has a real symbolic meaning to not only the community but themselves. And so in that process, they become enriched as individuals. But when you got the cheap copies coming in, all of that fades into the past. I know, like Mr. Garcia said, back in the 60s, we had the Lummi Weavers Association that was trying to revive wool weaving. We used to have the woolly dog and mountain goat wool. But instead, we had to convert to sheep wool. But we still had the weavers and basket weavers. And so through the 60s, during the War on Poverty program, we've seen a lot of elders have a vision where they're going to be able to teach us to do that art and that there would be a market and opportunity. But that all faded with the, as he said, with the competition that came in. It seemed that all the effort of the national government to give us the opportunity to get involved in the tourist economy was destroyed by the copies that came in and replaced us.
President Lewis, do you want to elaborate?
Kind of agree with Mr. James there, just to elaborate on that a little bit as far as the tribes in Arizona are concerned. There are some tribes that are a lot more into the arts and crafts market than other tribes, and I know that the communities are affected by these counterfeits, by the money that comes back to the community from what these arts and crafts people make. They come back to the community. They buy at their stores. They buy at their gas stations. They buy from different businesses within the reservation. So it does affect the tribe as far as economically, and some tribes do get hurt by that more than others.
Is there any statistics in terms of what percentage of the monthly income would you say is provided through the sales of Indian arts and craft for Indian tribes in the areas? Is there any statistics?
I do not have any of those.
None that I know of. That's why I was asking. It would be good to do a study to see what. I mean, in New Mexico, there's literally thousands of artisans in the Rio Grande tribes and stuff.
Okay.
One thing, if I may, Mr. Chairman, is make a recommendation for consideration to do a detailed critique of the bill, because we, the Indian Arts and Crafts Association, would like to have the opportunity to make some suggestions if possible.
Okay. I know that my time has expired, but thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I was listening with great interest in my office and was caught by one of the comments made by one of you in regard to suicide amongst your youth, which brings me to then what Mr. Baca was referring to is the training capability, the jobs development, the development of tourism to be able to have your youngsters have something to look forward to. With the idea that we may end up having another, not a stimulus, but a support for job development, can you tie in any of what you feel needs to be done, aside from enforcement, to be able to do job development for your young people and some of your unemployed? Because I know you have a very high unemployment rate. Would you care to address that?
If I may, we have language that we're asking for consideration by the committee that reads as follows. The Congress hereby recognizes, for purposes of a clarification, that traditional Indian arts and crafts, when associated with traditional stories of conservation, are qualified forms of modern-day fisheries management and protection activity tied to and associated directly with tribal fisheries and natural resources management, and are protected by the same laws that may before, now, or hereafter be applied to the treaty fishing rights. The reason we introduced that language is that we have a long history, about 30 years of litigation, more like 50 years of litigation that was successful to try to reestablish our Pacific Northwest Treaty protected fishing. And in U.S. versus Washington, the court ruled that we had a right to commercial harvest, subsistence, and ceremonial. And at the time, the state tried to deny that the Native Americans had any knowledge at all about fisheries biology or fish hatchery operations. And our elders appeared in court and said, no, we have stories about how to love and respect the salmon in the rivers. And it's called Salmon Woman Stories, Part 1 and Part 2. So they testified to that, and the court recognized that we do have a deep culture and an understanding of how we relate to the environment. And so without a further definition in the court, of course, we're now seeing that that right to use our symbols and our arts and crafts as a part of our fisheries marketing regime, that we're being challenged by entities such as the Internal Revenue Service, who wants their share of any proceeds. And so it discourages the artists. We now have elder artists on Lummi because of the 1099 requirements that will no longer even sell their art to the tribal government because they know that they'll file a 1099. And this is spreading throughout our artist community. That's why we're saying that if we could develop our fisheries as well as our arts and crafts in a joint effort, we can put some of our fishing families back to work in the art industry. They can carve the totem poles and the masks. They can make the two-dimensional prints or the jewelry that is tied to these stories, and tourists will come.
Okay, well, what I was getting to is being able to help you develop more job opportunities, not only for yourselves but for your other tribes. But that leads back to the enforcement issue. To Mr. Parkinson, what keeps the department? Is it lack of staffing? Is it funding to be able to follow through on some of the complaints that have been made to the agency so that there can be some redress for them, or at least send a note out or a warning out to those fraudulent copiers, if you will, that there is going to be enforcement and steps taken to be able to go after them, especially if they're items that have been registered or there is a sign on them that you do not duplicate.
I think that would, in Europe, they have a system called a hallmarking system. And I think one of the northern tribes of up in Alaska area have one too. But I think if we could do something like that, the thing that was most intrigued me about Europe, and it's all over Europe and in the UK, is it's like the seal of approval. It tests the metals, it tests the stone. You basically send it to an assay office. They assay the metals, the solder, everything, and they put like a laser symbol on it or some type of symbol depending on what region it comes from in Europe, but some kind of symbol, authenticity symbol. We're going to need some kind of hallmarking system.
And maybe all the tribes can get together and determine to do one that represents all of your work.
Or different regions.
But, right. But I'm asking Mr. Parkinson for an answer in regard to funding, to personnel to be able to deal with those issues. I'm sorry, the gentleman. Mr. Lewis, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry, I thought you were referring to.
Well, I was trying to get the agency to respond to find out whether it is an issue of funding and lack of personnel or lack of will from whether it's the administration or somebody else to get them protected.
I think perhaps the Assistant Secretary who testified earlier might be in a better position to respond to the gentlelady's question.
Thank you, sir.
And I'll allow him to come back.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Congresswoman. It clearly is a matter of resources. I don't know if I think you came in after my testimony. The Indian Arts and Crafts Board has a staff of 12. About half of those staff are dedicated to the three museums out in the field, which leaves five, sometimes six staffers
nationwide
at the board level. The entire budget is approximately $1 million for the Indian Arts and Crafts Board. When there is a complaint, the board routinely does send a letter of warning to the transgressor or the alleged transgressor. Sometimes that works. Oftentimes it does not. And what it really ends up, what it comes back to, is the enforcement capacity and capabilities out in the field. And that's pretty limited. There have been a very small number. You can count on one hand the number of prosecutions there have been on the enforcement side.
Do you have any record of how many claims or complaints there have been that have been sent warnings, whether there's been a follow-up, whether there's been any other action taken to protect them?
I don't personally know that offhand, but the director of the Indian Arts and Crafts Board is behind me, Meredith Stanton. She may have that. If not, we'll get back to you.
Excuse me, would you come to the microphone and identify yourself so we all can hear?
It goes on the record that, because you can't hear you.
Just grab a microphone there, yep.
In terms of
identify yourself, please.
Oh, I'm sorry, my name is Meredith Stanton. I'm the director of the Indian Arts and Crafts Board with the Department of the Interior. In terms of concrete numbers, I'd be happy to get those to you.
Would you provide them for today. This committee, please?
Yes, I'll be happy to.
And also, any information that would help us understand what kind of budget would be necessary or what is necessary to be able to begin to address not only past transgressions, but protect them in the future so they be able to continue trying to build up their own economy.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, Mr. Garcia.
I think suggestion that I thought about is to, you mentioned about warning people about not to be trafficking and counterfeiting, is to have a high profile case and just make an example of them that we're not going to stand for this anymore. I mean, if it's a $1 billion industry and 60% of it's going to fakes, something's wrong with that picture.
But that also involves, I'm sure, importing from other countries. So that it isn't just the U.S., not only nation copy, but it's foreign copies. Am I correct?
There's a significant problem with foreign importation. You're absolutely right, Congresswoman. That's a huge problem in this.
But how do we deal with it? Do we do it at the tariff? Do we do it? Does the State Department get involved? Mr. Chair, I think there's questions here as to whether or not we will continue to allow imports to challenge and take over or at least diminish the capability of our Native Americans.
I think from our perspective, the first line of defense ought to be fundamentally enforcing it, because even if they're imported, if they're marketed as Indian arts and crafts and they're not genuine, that's a violation of the statute and it ought to be enforced.
And whose responsibility would that be?
Well, that's the legislation here would expand that. Right now, that responsibility lies with the FBI. And the purpose of the legislation that's in front of you today is to expand the enforcement capacity beyond the FBI so that any federal law enforcement agency could do that.
Would that also help your board, ma'am, be able to deal with it and have somebody that would go after these perpetrators?
Absolutely.
Alleged perpetrators?
Yes, yes, sir.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think we all have before us a case of being able to take a strong stand, as Mr. Garcia was saying, to ensure that the word starts going out, whether it's a high-profile case or not, that our Native Americans have long been ignored in many areas. And this is another one, talking about some of the areas that we work with in my subcommittee, but this is another that I think if we are to protect our own job development, our own areas, then I think we need to start right here. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
A gentleman from New Mexico, Mr. Heinrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Welcome, Mr. Garcia. I want to go to something a little bit different within the legislation and ask you about the importance of civil actions in deterring the sale of counterfeit products. And my understanding is that the bill clarifies that a civil suit can be brought by an attorney general, an Indian tribe, an Indian arts and crafts organization. Can you elaborate a little bit, and forgive me if this question is redundant since I missed the first part of the hearing, but why is it so important to include civil actions as part of the enforcement system?
To make them stop. I mean, it has to stop. It really does. I mean, they're destroying our culture. They're destroying our traditions. Something has to be done, whether it's on the federal level. So, I mean, whatever level we can. I mean,
let me ask you in a different sort of way, because I very much appreciate what this is trying to get at. Has the FBI been effective at upholding this law?
Well, they've been out. They've come out and investigated a few cases, and I've been, you know, with them and around New Mexico and stuff. But I mentioned you have to be careful because mm-hmm. I've been threatened, you know, because there's a lot of money at stake,
right?
And stuff, and I worry about my family. And at the time I did get threatened, I did back off. I got scared.
Wow.
But I was with Meredith Stanton and another gentleman. I think he was an FBI officer. We were walking around the plaza and kind of pointing out people and violations and things that was suspect.
In Old Town or in Santa Fe?
Downtown Santa Fe.
Oh, in Santa Fe, okay.
And stuff. And it's kind of, it's scary in a way. And after that happened, I totally backed away for quite a while.
Right.
And then I started getting more involved with art organizations and stuff. But it's like I said, it can be scary. It's not just a walk in the park. There's
right.
a lot of money at stake here.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would submit that this is incredibly important at a time when the FBI can be prioritized on other issues at times, that we have a number of different ways to address this issue and include people like our attorneys generals and the various Indian arts and crafts organizations to be able to come at this in a number of different ways, because a one-dimensional approach has not been effective in the past. And I have to say, as somebody who is a consumer of many of these items, you know, just having finished my holiday shopping and purchased many items, that some of which I can absolutely guarantee were what they were represented to be, others of which, you know, are hard to tell. And I think the public deserves that sort of truth in labeling and the confidence that they're supporting their local economy and real Indian artists. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
If I may, one...
Mr. Garcia.
Sure.
Back to your questions about civil actions. Anytime there's any kind of lawsuit, there's money involved. And a lot of the problem is attorney's fees. You know, so civil action could get, we could get cover attorney fees and plus triple or double the damages and stuff too. So that
was it. Thank you, Mr. Garcia. I yield back, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Gentlemen, again, we thank you for being with us today and testifying on this important issue, and we'll continue to work with you as we move forward.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you.
No further business. Committee stands adjourned.